He flies the airship away from the chaos of the social club. The heat warms me, and I stop shivering so hard. A bribe? Hawthorne's expression turns brooding. What do you do when the son you sent away at 10 suddenly returns and holds your future in his hands? He asks. You're loved, Hawthorne. He gives me a side-eyed look. They don't love me. No, I do. He turns to me. I love you too, Roselle. So maybe you can understand how I felt when I saw you throw yourself off a building, clutching a man who held an incendiary device. You could have vaporized before my eyes. They killed my father. I can hardly say it without choking. Kennett didn't love me. I know that. But now he never will. I lost my chance. My heart feels puncture, as if it's being forced through the narrow space between my ribs. I didn't know how much I was holding out hope that he'd one day love me, until this moment. Someone had to stop those soldiers from killing everyone. I could, so I did. If you love me like I love you, you won't do anything like that again. I look away. I can't promise you that. I'm second born. You think I care that you're second born? He snarls, and then clenches his teeth. The only person I care about is you. I'm still a soldier. It's my job to... You're so much more than a soldier. Just promise me you won't do anything reckless like that again. Everything is about to change. The Rose Garden Society has an agenda, and you're at the top of it. You know as well as I do what Salloway is planning. After tonight, it won't just be Gabriel's death they call for. Salloway and his cronies will up their timeline. What do you mean by that? Who do you think had your father killed tonight? He asks with a note of cynicism that was never there when he was second born. I would have thought it was the Rose Garden Society. Don't get me wrong, they wanted Kennett dead. But Kennett wasn't just executed, Roselle. He was tortured. Someone hated him enough to make it extremely painful. It wasn't just political. It was personal. Mother, I say. A lot of people had a motive to kill my father, but no one hated him like my mother did. Kennett would have inherited the title of the Virtue before I would. Dune and the Gates of Dawn want me to rule. I'm closer now that my father is dead, but the viciousness of Kennett's murder is not their style. They would have simply put a fusion pulse in his head. Mother sent the death gods to brutalize my father. If they'd caught me, would they have tortured me as well? Othala hasn't been able to get to you at the Halo Palace, so she changed her line of attack, Hawthorne says. If she becomes the Virtue, she'd rule everything. Now that your father is dead, she's one step closer to her goal. That's bad for the Rose Gardeners. They need you to become the firstborn heir to the sword before your mother has a chance to become the Virtue, or you're as good as dead. If she eliminates all the other heirs to the title, then everyone bows down to Othala, and she saves her son. My mother would then become the Virtue, and Gabriel would become the sword. I'd still be a threat to Gabriel, so they'd get rid of me. Then Gabriel will inherit the title of the Virtue when my mother dies. Hawthorne's expression is grim. But Othala can't save Gabriel. He's the only one who can do that, but he won't. No one needs to kill him. He's doing that all by himself. He's completely psychotic now that he's mixing Rush with 500. I cringe. A painful ache squeezes my heart. Separately, the drugs Hawthorne is talking about are dangerous. Together, they're lethal. Something can be done. Gabriel doesn't care about anything except getting high and killing you. In a broken whisper, I ask, how are you still alive, Hawthorne? The night I left him, he'd betrayed my brother, a death sentence in the Fate of Swords, especially if Gabriel is as sick as he says. I don't know, Hawthorne admits. He sighs, as if he's trying to sort it out. Your family doesn't know what we did the night you escaped. Everything was erased. Erased? How? The security logs were all compromised. Not one drone camera, security camera, satellite, or Majino recorded us. Not on the Sword Palace grounds, or in the streets of the city, or even near your apartment. Every file was corrupted. They're all blank. Tracking in the city of Forge was wiped out, a total blackout. Gabriel and Athala suspect the Virtue is behind it. My eyebrows pull together. The only explanation is that once the malware I uploaded into the Majino infiltrated the industrial systems, Raiken took over and covered our tracks. That must have been risky. He could have let Hawthorne burn for what he did that night. It would have been smarter where the Gates of Dawn are concerned. No one would suspect a breach. Maybe Raiken's program is such a ghost that it doesn't matter? What are you thinking about? Hawthorne asks. I was wondering how that's possible. I've wondered the same thing. At first I thought Gabriel was playing me, but then it became clear that he truly doesn't know what happened that night. What did you tell him? I told him you slipped away. I followed you and the Majino, but you were able to escape your apartment, where you were met by the Virtue and taken away. I stare out the side window. They still believe you'd murder me if given the chance? I don't know, maybe. Things changed after that night. Gabriel has become more and more deranged. I'm his first lieutenant. I run the Heritage Council now, but we haven't met in days because there's no point. No information is coming from the Sword Palace. Gabriel doesn't leave its walls for his own protection, and no one's allowed to see him. Is anyone getting him help? I ask. The only person who isn't terrified of Gabriel is your mother, and I think she's in denial. She's like a lioness. I don't believe the Rose Garden Society saw tonight's attack coming. Salloway would never have put you in danger like that if he had. Neither would Dune, I think. Have you spoken to Clifton? Hawthorne grunts. You think Salloway talks to me? The derision in his tone is telling. He'd never let me near you if he could help it. My brow wrinkles in confusion. But you were at the party tonight. Surely Clifton would have made certain that you weren't on the guest list, if that were the case. I didn't have an invitation. I snuck in tonight. Came in through the roof. I had to try to see you. He puts the airship on autopilot. Reaching up, he unclasps his chest armor and opens the side, exposing a gravitizer inside the breastplate. We employ these anti-gravity mechanisms in combat jumpsuits. They use a magnetic force to repel themselves from the molten core of the planet and slow the descent during airship jumps. That explains how Hawthorne survived the fall from the building and his plunge into the water to rescue me. I was locating a quiet place in the social club where I could bring you to talk, and then I was going to find you when you walked by. I was following my father. I realized that I might have been able to save Kennet if I hadn't been distracted by Hawthorne. He reads my face. I'm glad I stopped you. They might have killed you, too. Did you see Dune or Clifton during the mayhem in the ballroom? No, I was only watching you, he replies. A grudging tone of admiration enters his voice. You destroyed them all, Roselle. They didn't even stand a chance. I could hardly take my eyes off you. Even when I temporarily blinded everyone? I was on the gallery level. Your red cloud didn't make it up there to the end of the gallery. I watched you shoot every single target. Then you stopped my heart, throwing yourself on the grenade. After the glass blew in from the explosion, I saw you fall. I ran along the balcony and dove through a window after you. That was brave of you, I murmur. Brave. Hawthorne laughs self-effacingly. It was self-preservation, Roselle. I'm lost without you. I reach my hand out to his. He takes it and holds it. I've been to the Halo Palace a handful of times, hoping you were there, demanding they let me see you. My eyes widen. No one told me. I figured as much when your mentor informed me that I should move on with my life. Dune said that? I shift in my seat. My side aches, making it hard to breathe. I can't find a comfortable position. Yeah, he said. Secondborns don't have the luxury of friends. as if I have no clue what it's like to be a secondborn, as if I don't understand the dehumanization and subjugation, being treated like a piece of meat. Then he gave orders not to let me back in the Halo Palace without an invitation. Anger swells in my heart. All this time I've been worrying that Hawthorne was dead. Dune could have easily assuaged my fear, but that didn't fit into his agenda. No longer surrounded by skyscrapers and the bright lights of the city, I wonder for the first time where Hawthorne is taking me. The night travels by. I don't care where we go. I just want to keep flying and never look back. I wonder if there's any place in the world to hide with Hawthorne. It's too hard to be without him, every night lonesome and long. The aircraft slows and descends, passing over a tall wall that has a fusion-powered security dome. As we near the energy field, a hole develops, allowing Hawthorne's airship to enter before it closes behind us. We circle a sprawling estate centered amid pastoral grounds. The house itself is old and majestic, made of stone and glass with cathedral peaks. "You live here?" I ask. The airship sets down on a hover pad adjacent to the formal entrance of the mansion. "It's my family home in Virtues. This is Lenity. We're just outside of Purity." An illuminated path leads through a formal garden to the stone steps of the house. Lenity is the sister city of Purity, but I don't see a city. I just see land and lakes in every direction. Hawthorne powers down the engines. My mouth hangs open a little in awe. "This is quite a change from the air barracks. It must keep you busy." "The secondborn staff runs the place. I have very little to do." Opening his door, he climbs out, pulls his armor from his chest, and sets it aside on the ground. He closes his door and walks around to my side, unlatching my door and offering me his hand. I take it. As he pulls me up, I wince. My ribs feel cracked. My hand goes to my side. "Are you okay?" Hawthorne asks, concern etched in the lines on his face. "One of the death gods slammed me into the railing. I think I cracked a rib. Hitting the water like a brick didn't help."
"Can you walk?"
I nod. "Yes, it just hurts." I limp forward. My boots squish with water.
"Hold on."
Hawthorne bends down and pulls my boots off, leaving them on the ground. The powerful muscles of his side look a little like shark gills. He straightens, and I get to see him in just a leather war skirt and sandals. My heart beats harder. My cheeks feel flushed.
"Better?"
he asks. I nod. He takes my arm gingerly, hugging me to his side with his arm around my waist for support. We follow the illuminated path through the gardens. "Tell me about your house," I urge, trying to think about anything other than the ache in my side.
"The original house was a gift to my great-great-I-don't-even-know-how-many-greats-grandfather, from the Virtue of a few hundred years ago, for some act of bravery. My father went on and on about it when I told him I was coming here to get away from Forge for a while."
"What act of bravery?"
"I don't know. I wasn't listening."
"Hawthorne," I chide him. Hawthorne's expression turns stormy.
"My father didn't care what happened to me for the past 10 years, and now he wants my attention?" His jaw tightens. "Now he wants me to care how we got a pile of stone and mortar, like it means something?"
"It doesn't. It's all just stuff, possessions. You and I never needed any of this. We had each other." All this time that I've been struggling with the loss of him, he's been doing the same and trying to adjust to a life and a family that never wanted him. "You're right. They can have only what you want to give them, and nothing more." We take a few more steps. "But," Hawthorne slows, "I'm not sure they're entirely to blame. They didn't make the laws." He resumes a faster pace.
"No, they just follow them unquestioningly."
The front of the house is a gigantic open archway with no doors. A security field of soft golden light shines down from the keystone.
Uplighting from the base of the structure makes it look like some monster about to swallow us whole in the moonlight. I'm able to pass through the security field with Hawthorne because of his moniker. Had I been alone, it may not have allowed me access. On the other side of the entryway, the floor is made of rough black slate with fossilized pyrite swords embedded in the stone. The foyer branches off in several directions, taking different paths. The ceilings are a couple of stories high, with a gallery and a clerestory above the nave-like entrance. Skylights glow with moonlight. It's obvious that the exterior walls were once made of ornate stone, but some have been replaced by invisible, open-air security fields, so that the outside merges with the inside, a connection with nature. It's fascinatingly beautiful, and so different from where we come from, Hawthorne and me. We lived in a windowless, tree-shaped fortress and air barracks, hardly ever seeing the outside unless we were fighting or mobilizing. Now his house is literally a part of the landscape. A sleepy-looking secondborn with a brown mountain range moniker enters the foyer. He stops short when he sees us. His hand moves to the side of his head in an "oh dear" gesture. "Sir," he says.
"Send a medical drone to my quarters, Ashby," Hawthorne orders.
"Would you like a tray as well?" Ashby inquires, eyeing the smudges our dirty feet have left on the slate floor.
"Yes, thank you. Just send it with a mecadome and go back to bed."
"Very good, sir. Will our guest be staying for the evening?"
"Good night, Ashby," Hawthorne replies.
Hawthorne takes me to his quarters at the back of the house on the main floor. His bedroom is nearly barren, except for a very large bed and a couple of large wingback chairs. There are only three solid walls. A fourth side is open to the outdoors. The seating stands in front of this non-existent fourth wall. Without the lights on, it's easy to see outside. The view of the lake is gorgeous in the moonlight.
"Someone stole your wall," I murmur.
Hawthorne snorts with laughter. "There's a wall. It's an invisible security field. You can't walk through it unless you have my moniker or you're touching me. It allows in the breeze but keeps out the bugs."
A warm wind blows in off the lake outside. In the distance looms a wilderness of trees. I hear their leaves rustling and the sound of the frogs and insects chirping. I'm unaccustomed to it, but it appeals to me on a visceral level.
"Low light," Hawthorne orders.
Dim illumination pushes away the darkness. Hawthorne shows me to the attached bathing area. An array of automated white candles flames to life as we enter. At the far end of the chamber, a huge claw-footed tub sits on a floor of limestone. The outside wall has been removed here as well, replaced by an invisible security field. Smooth river stones and stepping stones lead to a walled garden beyond. Flowering trees and topiaries offer some privacy, but the starry night is perfectly unobscured. Hawthorne lets go of me. I lean against a stone countertop by a sink while he goes to the tub. It has a spout on either end. One is for water, and the other, to my surprise, is for ice. He turns them both on. Cold water streams from the tap. Ice is dispensed and floats on the surface.
"I prefer hot water," I say with a frown.
He glances at me over his shoulder.
"This is better for your ribs. I'll give you some anti-inflammatory tablets and a bone refortification injection, but nothing works like ice."
He trails his hand in the frigid water.
"That looks like pure torture," I reply.
A small smile tugs at his lips.
"It's a far cry from the showers in Tritium 101.
I think of the air barracks where we shared a locker room when he was mine. It seems like another lifetime, wholly disconnected from this one. Behind me, the medical drone hovers in the doorway. Its long, bullet-shaped body is just narrow enough to fit through the wide doorway. Soundlessly, it creeps into the room. Hawthorne programs it to scan me from head to toe. Because it's a private device, it doesn't need to interface with my moniker.
Its readouts indicate that two of my ribs are indeed fractured, and I have multiple contusions riddling my body. Two syringes of medication are injected into my side, followed by a pain reliever. An anti-inflammatory is next, followed by skin regeneration therapy. After the drone is finished with me, Hawthorne allows it to tend to his injuries. He gets a spray of skin regenerator and a laser seal on the worst of his cuts and burns, then a bandage that covers his entire forearm. "I can wrap your ribs after you soak in the ice. Do you need help?" he asks. I try to reach my arms back to unlace my leather halter. I wince. "Yes, I need help," I admit. "First things first," Hawthorne says. Retrieving scissors from a drawer, he gently lifts my hair and begins the arduous task of unbraiding it and cutting out the thorny vines. When he's finished, he sets the scissors aside. Warm fingers brush my wavy hair away from my back and over my shoulder so he can get to the laces of my halter top. Slowly, he unties the strings. Heat flushes my cheeks at his touch. With the laces undone, the small scrap of leather covering my breasts falls away. His hands encircle my waist from behind, unfastening my belt. The iron strap clangs against the floor. The leather of my pants is torn in several places, but it clings to me like a second skin. Strong fingers grasp the waistband on either side of my hips, tugging my pants down so I don't have to bend. Hawthorne crouches behind me, easing them past my thighs and ankles. I step out of them. Rising, Hawthorne stands behind me once more. Gently, he pulls my naked form against him, while his head bends to my throat. His lips are a whisper as he kisses my neck for a moment, and then his hand slides to my elbow, urging me toward the tub. Goosebumps immediately break out on my flesh when I step into the water. "Hawthorne, this is completely sadistic." He chuckles and squeezes my elbow. "I promise I'll warm you up when it's over." I lower myself into the water and hug my knees. After a minute, I force myself to lie back and rest against the slope of the tub. Hawthorne mumbles, "I'll get you a robe." He leaves. The CR-40 begins to dissolve and peel from my hand. My silver moniker shines up, a sword slicing through the water. The crown-like shadow at the top of the sword appears to be riding on a cube of ice. Hawthorne returns. My eyes devour him. He's still shirtless, but he has changed from his Tyburn costume into a pair of long black pants. They hang loose on his hips, showing a deep V of rippling muscles. The sight of him should be enough to melt all the ice in this bath, but I continue to shiver. The pain is nearly unbearable. My lips must be bluer than when he pulled me from the lake. I sit forward, my hands gripping the edge of the bath. "Had enough?" Hawthorne asks. I nod, my teeth rattling. He unfolds a black silk robe and holds it out for me. I climb over the edge of the tub. Water drips off me onto the floor. His arms embrace me, threading mine through the robe's sleeves, which are way too long. "Is this your robe?" I ask, trying to stifle a frigid tremor.
"Yes."
"Are you aware that you have monster arms?" I let the fabric dangle to illustrate my point. He grins.
"No, I wasn't aware of that."
"They're goonish." I scrunch the fabric up so that my hands emerge. "I feel the bad for you."
"Maybe you have T-Rex arms. Have you thought of that?"
"No one has mentioned it before."
"I never wanted to bring it up."
"Can you sit on the edge of the tub?" he asks. I nod, my teeth still chattering, and sit down with my back as straight as possible. From his pocket, Hawthorne extracts a bandage and a roll of medical tape. He kneels in front of me. Using a towel, he dries my chest and abdomen before wrapping the bandage around my ribcage and then binding it tight with the tape. "This is old-fashioned," I murmur. "They have laser fusion for broken ribs." Hawthorne grimaces.
"I hate that surgery. I'd rather tape them." In my opinion, this hurts less. We used to do this instead of the invasive procedure at the base. It takes longer to heal, though.
He pauses, and his gaze meets mine.
I can't do that surgery here. My medical drone isn't equipped. I'd have to take you to a medical facility. Do you want me to?
I frown. No, they'll separate us.
They're going to do that anyway, Roselle. We'll have to submit to questioning at some point, but I'm hoping to avoid it for as long as possible.
I've had the laser fusion procedure done a few times. You're right. It hurts like someone is soldering your guts. I'd rather you tape them instead.
Hawthorne nods and resumes the work of bandaging my ribs. When he's finished, he pulls the sides of the robe closed and ties the belt.
His hands take mine, and he helps me to my feet.
His fingers feel hot. The robe is too long. I look down at my hidden feet and the pool of fabric on the floor.
Giant, I whisper.
His hands let go of mine. He cups my face and leans down to brush my lips with a tender kiss.
Your giant, he whispers.
Yes, my giant. I deepen the kiss, even though my side aches unceasingly. Sensing my pain, Hawthorne pulls away and takes one of my hands. We walk to his room. A tea urn, cups, and a tear tray laden with petite sandwiches rest atop a hovering cart. Hawthorne pours me a cup and offers it on a saucer. I ignore the saucer, lifting the delicate porcelain in my frigid grasp. It's piping hot. I take a small sip, feeling its warmth all the way to my belly. He pours another cup for himself. We both devour the finger food, standing over the tray like heathens. A yawn escapes me. Hawthorne takes my empty cup. With a hand on my back, he leads me to his bed. Gingerly, I climb in. I try to lie on my back, but it's intolerable, so I turn onto my left side. There isn't a comfortable position.
Do you want another pain reliever? He asks.
I nod. He gives me a tablet and some water. I swallow it and then lie back. Hawthorne settles in next to me, spooning me, careful to rest his arm on my hip instead of my ribs. The heat radiating from him is irresistible. I press my back firmly against his chest. He kisses my hair. What we're doing is a crime, a punishable offense. A secondborn in the same bed as a firstborn is even more taboo than two secondborns being caught together. Unless it's a sanctioned encounter in a pleasure house, regulated, restricted to a one-time event, with no relationship or offspring resulting, it's a violation of law. But this is intimacy. The deadliest crime. The penalty for me is much more severe than it would be for him. He'd pay a fine. I'd pay the price. The danger suits me. I thread my fingers through his.
Missed you. I whisper.
I don't sleep well without you. I keep reaching for you, but you're never there.
I'm here now.
We need a plan.
I know. I try to focus on the problem, to come up with a plan that allows me to stay with Hawthorne, but his snuggling is like a lullaby, and I can't even find a way to stay awake.
Pressure on my side brings me up from a deep sleep. I want to ignore it, but the hand squeezes tighter. Pain brings my eyebrows together. I whimper. It's hard to breathe without my whole side aching. I open my eyes. It's near dawn. The horizon is a bruising of light, blocked by a dark silhouette. I lift my head from the pillow. My vision blurs from exhaustion. Blinking a few times, my eyes focus. Raikin is seated in one of the wingback chairs, blotting out the view of the lake. A tight black shirt and military-style pants highlight his formidable figure. I almost don't see the black fusion mag resting on his lap. The golden light of his shooting star moniker hides beneath a black leather glove. I haven't seen him seethe with anger like this since I first encountered him on the battlefield.
"Get your clothes," he says.
Hawthorne, still spooning me, whispers in my ear,
"Don't move." His hand on my hip is no longer heavy, but tense, poised.
"What are you doing here?" I ask Raiken. Fear wends its way through me. He clutches the weapon in his lap threateningly.
"I came to rescue you," he says with the menacing ring of hard-fought patience.
"Rescue me?" My groggy mind stutters. It takes me a second to remember last night.
"Get your clothes."
Raiken doesn't raise his voice, but it feels like he slapped me. I tense with a sick dread that he'll hurt Hawthorne if I don't obey him.
"Who are you?" Hawthorne snarls. "How did you get past my security?"
Raiken doesn't answer him, but continues to stare at me with barely controlled rage. I mutter,
"It's complicated, Hawthorne."
I raise myself up on my elbow and wince. My fingers go to my sore ribs, holding them, hoping to stave off the pain. It does little. I turn to Raiken.
"Put your gun away." "You'll be lucky if I don't shoot him," he replies. "Now get dressed. We're leaving."
Hawthorne saved my life last night.
"So you slept with him?"
It's not a question. It's an accusation. The rumble of Hawthorne's deep voice contains its own barely restrained fury.
"Who is this, Roselle?"
My eyes narrow at Raiken. I shift, moving my feet to the floor and sitting up with difficulty. My hair falls in my face. I bend at the waist, hoping to gain some relief. But it doesn't help, so I straighten.
"Who are you?" Hawthorne roars at Raiken.
Instead of answering, Raiken asks him,
"Did you tell her that you're engaged?"
My gasp feels like a knife through the ribs, straight into my heart. Hawthorne's jaw is rigid. I try to meet his eyes, but he won't look at me.
"I'm not engaged," he denies. "Oh, no?" Raiken asks. "I just imagined that announcement this week in the Sword Social."
I know the Firstborn Star is telling the truth. He doesn't lie to me.
"I didn't agree to it."
Resentment is thick in Hawthorne's tone. "My parents made that marriage contract without my consent. Fauna Kinrig was my brother Flint's fiancé. They think I have a moral obligation to fulfill that promise to her."
Raiken's blue eyes are unwavering. "That will be a difficult contract to break. The Kinrigs are powerful. I'm sure they like the sound of Fauna Truegrave just a little too much, given what comes with the name."
"Hard to break, but not impossible.
Do you know what would happen to Roselle, a secondborn, if she were found like this in your bed? They'd whip the skin off her back, and that's just the beginning. And do you know what would happen to you?"
He pauses.
"Nothing. You'd get to live on and marry Firstborn Kinrig."
I get to my feet, unable to sit any longer. My ribs are aching and my heart is breaking. I clutch my side and move toward the bathroom.
"Roselle!" Hawthorne calls. "Don't move," Raiken orders him, raising the barrel of the fusion mag.
I enter the bathroom and close the door. My clothes are still on the limestone floor near the bath. Gathering them, I shrug the leather top over my bandaged ribs, pain stabbing in my side. Cold sweat breaks out on my brow. I refuse to call Raiken to help me. I don't even know if he would. Instead, I reach behind me, holding my breath against the agony, and tie the laces myself. The pants are a little easier to manage. I don't have my boots, but I'm not sure I could put them on anyway. Glancing in the mirror, I'm not surprised to see deep blue and purple bruises on my shoulders and arms. Cuts from shattered glass and thorns still mar my skin, despite the round of skin regeneration therapy. In short, I'm a mess. I rummage in a drawer near the sink, finding toothpaste. I rub some on the tip of my finger and clean my teeth. When I'm done, I use a smear of toothpaste to write the coordinates of my Halo Palace apartment on the mirror. Both Hawthorne and Raiken are on their feet, sizing each other up, when I exit the bathroom.
"Let's go,"
I order Raiken, holding my side. His eyes widen in surprise. I don't think he realized the extent of my injuries. The black robe had covered a multitude of wounds.
Now they're a billboard on my skin.
Roselle, Hawthorne growls between clenched teeth. He doesn't understand what's happening here.
It's okay, Hawthorne. I try to give him a reassuring smile. He won't hurt me. He'll take me back to the Halo Palace where I'll be protected. You don't have to worry.
Who is he? Hawthorne demands.
If I tell you, he'll kill you. Trust me, Hawthorne. It's better this way. I'll see you soon.
Hawthorne is visibly shaking with rage. He points at Raiken. If you hurt her, I'll rip your heart out. It's already gone, Raiken retorts.
The belligerent firstborn star gestures to the door. We pass through to a small garden and into the shadows of a coming dawn.
Chapter 10. The Nature of Dawn.
I hold my stinging ribs, silently cursing Raiken. Speckled with stones, moss, and prickly things, a path winds through the majestic trees and shrubbery. The stones dig into my bare feet. Raiken trails behind me. My pace is slow because every step hurts. He touches my elbow. I ease my arm away from him, even though I could use the support. We trudge along the path, and every few steps Raiken glances behind us, maybe expecting to see Hawthorne. He won't. Hawthorne is stealth itself. He won't try anything, though, not with Raiken training his fusion mag on me. We make it to the tree line near the lake. Just inside the copse, a black airship rests beneath a small pile of fir boughs. Raiken pulls them off the concealed airship. The sun hasn't broken the horizon, but the gray shadows are pushing back. Raiken opens the co-pilot door for me. I hold my breath, carefully climbing onto the seat. He closes my door and rounds the airship. Once inside the two-seater aircraft, Raiken tucks his fusion mag into the black holster on the side of his chest. He spares little time getting us into the air. We fly low, skimming just above the leafy canopy, avoiding detection. The set of his jaw tells me I'm in dangerous territory with him. I'm confused about why, but I'm unwilling to ask. Nor will I explain myself to him. It's time he learns that he doesn't own me.
Have you ever thought about the nature of dawn? I ask.
Raiken doesn't answer.
I have. When you're a soldier, you think about those things, especially because you hardly ever see the sunrise unless you're in battle.
He doesn't look at me, but he's listening.
I've heard it said that dawn is the light, asking the night for permission to exist.
Raiken snorts rudely.
I agree, I reply, watching the sun break the plane of the horizon. I don't subscribe to that either. I believe dawn is the violent overthrow of night. But night is always still there, just on the periphery, waiting. And at the end of the day, it comes to claim us all.
I thought you were dead, Raiken shouts. My fingers curl on the armrest in reaction to his violent outburst.
Witnesses saw you push a man through a window at the top of the building. Sea-fated divers are dragging the lake beneath the social club, searching for your body.
People think I'm dead? I ask.
No one survives that fall.
I had hover discs on. One of them continued to work.
How did you find me?
I infiltrated the secure access at the Halo Palace and located your moniker tracking, and then I waited. At first there was nothing. You were just gone. But then I got a ping. It faded in and out, but it was there. The readings were bizarre. Spotty location, alarming health readouts, hypothermia, distress. I was sure you were alive, but being tortured.
My ribs are broken. I soaked in a bath of ice water last night. If you think that I derived any pleasure from it, I invite you to try it. I'll even break your ribs for you.
He makes a growling sound that raises the fine hairs on my arms.
I thought you and Truegrave. I know what you thought, and it's none of your business, I retort. It is my business. I can't hide you like I hid your friend Hammond. Most people know you on sight.
Don't try to shame me, Raiken. You spent the whole night and an entire day in my apartment alone with me. You're a firstborn. It's the same thing.
That was different.
How was it different? I ask.
It just was. I wasn't in your bed with you all night. Dune wasn't standing by the social club's lake, demanding it be drained.
I cringe. Does he know I'm alive?
He doesn't know for sure yet, Raiken admits.
You knew I was alive when my moniker showed the coordinates of Hawthorne's home, I press. Why didn't you tell him then?
He ignores my question. Tell me, why is Hawthorne still alive?
Your brother didn't kill him. Maybe your new firstborn sword changed his mind and decided your brother and mother were the safer side.
Hawthorne would never do that.
Desperate people do desperate things, Raiken replies.
He's alive because of you, I murmur.
Raiken's eyes narrow. I know it was you who saved him. You erased every trace of our escape from the Sword Palace that night.
I did that for you, not for him.
That was dangerous. It could have alerted them to the fact we'd infiltrated their systems.
They'll never find anything.
Do you think my family are the ones behind the attack last night?
Yes.
Is there evidence in any of their communications? Something we can use?
Raiken frowns. I don't know. I need to dig in and search for it, and that will take a while. But I know a few things. It wasn't Gates of Dawn who attacked last night, and I'd rule out the Rose Garden Society, seeing as how quite a few of them are dead now. They wouldn't shoot up their social club. Media outlets have already been calling it the Rose Goddess Massacre.
Why Rose Goddess? Why not Rose Garden?
They've been interviewing survivors all evening. The accounts of you defending sword-fated firstborns is becoming legendary. Complete idiots who attended other balls, like the one Grisham and I were at last evening, are actually upset that they weren't at your party to see the Goddess of War smote the Gates of Dawn.
I give him a side-eyed look. He stares at me derisively.
You didn't think the Virtue would call out your mother, did you? The Gates of Dawn are a good scapegoat. It makes the continued conflict more palatable, and you more of a heroine. The Virtue is biding his time. This attack binds Salloway closer to him. Their common enemy is proving to be a many-headed dragon.
I gaze out the window at the landscape flying by. Large tracts of land stretch as far as I can see. It's so green, the kind of green that you never see in the city.
Horses startle and run from our low-flying airship.
I watch for a long time. Raiken communicates with Dune, letting my ex-mentor know that he found me. When the messaging between them ends, the silence grows. I want to see my father, I murmur.
Raiken's face changes. He loses some of his anger. The struggle in his eyes is real. Roselle, I don't know how to tell you this, so I'm just going to say it. Your father was murdered last night.
I know. I saw him. I killed his murderers. I think the shock of what happened last night is finally wearing off. My hands are trembling, and my throat aches with emotion I refuse to show. He wanted to be buried in Virtues, beside his parents. He told me that. He said, don't let them entomb me in that sword whorehouse. We were at my grandfather's funeral. He was drunk, of course, but he made me swear not to let his body rot in the sword mausoleum.
He was the fated sword. Your mother is expected to hold his body in state and inter him in that shrine.
I grit my teeth. He didn't want to be there. It's insanity to give his body to his murderers. Do you know what they did to him?
No.
They cut out his tongue. They literally made him hold his tongue.
You can't stop what they'll do with his body. You won't even be allowed at his funeral.
He's right. Transitioned secondborns are rarely allowed to attend the funeral of a parent. In swords, it's usually because we die before our parents. But if that doesn't happen, the surviving secondborn isn't welcome at the funeral, because it makes the rest of the family uncomfortable, and maybe a little afraid for the firstborn.
This is an insane world, Raiken. I know,
I still need to see him. I need to say goodbye.
Your father was a cruel man.
Still. Raken sighs.
I'll see what I can do to find out where his body is.
We fly in silence to the gorgeous city of Purity, though I hardly see any of it because I'm lost in thought.
Raken?
Yes.
Can I ask you a question? About your family?
I glance at him. He nods.
After Census murdered them, did they allow you to bury them?
He stiffens.
No, he replies softly. My mother and brother were dragged through the streets of our town and then left in the square to rot. I wasn't allowed to move them. My father was killed trying to defend them. They set his body on fire.
I'm sorry, I whisper, holding back tears. I can't cry. Not now.
I shouldn't have yelled at you. I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's actually normal. After a battle, one or two fights between sword soldiers usually break out. Someone will accuse someone else of being reckless or thoughtless. They'll usually brawl. It's a reaction to fear. Fear turns to anger, and they need to put it somewhere or they'll turn it inward. It's probably healthier to vent it. You were afraid I was dead. When you found out I wasn't, your fear turned to anger.
You know what that means, right?
No, Raken replies. It means you care about me. He turns on me, his stare cold, devoid of emotion.
You've got it wrong. I care about no one. The only thing I want is revenge. You're a means to an end, Roselle. I need you to help me topple a government. As soon as we accomplish that, I'll have no more use for you.
I'm not sure why his words destroy me like they do. The heat of embarrassment floods my cheeks. You may not care about me, but you care about your brothers. I can see it on your face when you talk about them.
Not in the way you think. My heart is gone, Roselle.
I think it's the opposite. I think you carry around all their hearts now.
You don't know what you're talking about, he growls. Just do your job and I don't have to kill you.
His words are a punch in my stomach. Now who's the cruel man?
Did I hurt your feelings? He asks with derision.
I refuse to answer him. We're stopped by security at the Halo Palace gates. The airship hovers by the barriers as we wait for clearance. Our arrival causes an uproar. Drone cameras and beat reporters who lurk near the grounds converge on the airship, beating on the glass and yelling questions that are too muffled to make out. The guards draw their weapons on the raucous crowd, pushing them back. Our vehicle is quickly scanned and searched. An exo guard says,
"You're both required to report immediately to the upper Halo Pad 985. Do you need coordinates for the dock?"
"No," Raken replies.
The airship flies forward and into the sprawling landscape of the Halo Palace grounds. We gain altitude, lifting toward the golden halo-shaped crown. The sea beside us is magnificent. White flags and pointed spires from Valmora's sea fortress are visible as we climb higher, and the castle is surrounded by the crystal blue high tide.
Raken's tone is gruff as he says, "I was hoping to avoid this until later."
He scrutinizes me. The frown on his face indicates I'm a disaster.
"Just tell them what happened last night. You have nothing to hide."
I don't look at him, but I lift my arms and fight the urge to weave my hair into a thick plait.
"So you do believe that nothing happened between Hawthorne and me?" "You can hardly breathe. Whatever happened last night, it wasn't much fun."
"How do I explain how you found me?"
"You had Hawthorne contact me on your behalf because you're supposed to be my slave for the day."
I snort with derision. "I'd never do that. I'd contact Dune first."
"Then lie. Or maybe you can say that you asked Hawthorne to contact me because I care about you."
My heart aches. "Don't make me regret saving your life, Raken."
He lands the airship on a golden platform. Once it's secure, a wide hangar opens. The platform moves, swinging sideways, bringing us inside the hangar. The doors close, and Dune emerges from an interior doorway ahead of us. His face is lined with fatigue. Exiting the vehicle on my own, I walk to meet Dune. He watches me, his gaze missing nothing. His eyes shift to Raken.
"Thank you."
Dune's deep voice resonates in the hangar. Raken simply nods.
"How bad is it?"
Dune asks me. His concern is muted. Injury is part of Secondborn Sword life. It's unavoidable. "No worse than most of our training days," I reply with the same detachment.
"I'll have my physician examine you,"
Dune says. "It's unnecessary," I reply. Dune frowns.
"You're required to answer questions from the Virtue about last night."
I want to lash out at Dune for not allowing me some time to recover before subjecting me to an inquiry. The lack of empathy for me after what I've been through is appalling, though I expected it. I nod and force my anger down. Dune ushers me into the corridor. Raken trails us. I'm led to the grand foyer near the air elevators. Security has doubled. Everyone is scanned, even Dune, which makes me want to laugh. He wouldn't need a weapon to kill the Virtue. The portraits of Fabian Bowie and his wife, Adora, stare at us as we ascend the stairs. I need to hold on to the railing, and my progress is slow. Raken tries to take my elbow, but I snatch it away. Dune sees the exchange and frowns. I don't care what he thinks. I want nothing more than to return to my room and be left alone. I feel empty and torn. My mother and brother tried to kill me again last night. They murdered my father. Hawthorne will marry a firstborn named Fauna. She'll have his children, no matter what he says to the contrary. He'll give his second child to the Fate of Swords. Nothing will ever change. Tears well up in my eyes, but I force them back, hoping my numbness lasts just a little longer. I might fall apart if it doesn't. At the top of the stairs, a sophisticated reception area shines with ethereal light. Dune is immediately surrounded by the Virtue's staff. I'm relieved. I walk away from them to the wall of windows and gaze out at the view of purity. I cross my arms over my middle, holding myself. People I don't know hover around me. They also work for the Virtue. A lovely diamond-faded secondborn scurries to my side. Her violet hair is in a tight twist. Dewdrop indigo lights flash on her eyelashes. "Hi, I'm Glisten, an assistant to the Virtue. How are you feeling?" Her eyes move from mine as she peeks at the rest of me. Her smile slips a little, but when her eyes meet mine again, she brightens with even more fake cheer. "Is there anything I can get you?" she asks with enthusiasm. "No," I reply. Raken hovers near us.
"She'll take a sweater, slippers, some water, and a chet."
"No, she won't," I growl.
"Yes, she will.
Have you got all that, Glisten?" Raken's smile is devastatingly handsome. It annoys me.
Glisten is absolutely enthralled.
"Of course. What size slippers?"
I glower at her.
"Right," she says, backing away with her finger pointing behind her. "I'll just go look it up."
Glisten hurries away to do Raken's bidding.
If she only knew the real you, Raken, and not your playboy persona, she'd run away.
"Only you know the real me,"
he replies. "What are we waiting for?"
"I heard someone say Grisham is on his way up."
"Why are you still here?" I ask.
"I'm required to be here. And anyway, you're my slave for the day, remember? We firstborns take that power very seriously."
"Slave for a day only counts when it's firstborn to firstborn. I'm secondborn. I'm a slave all the time."
"Finally," he whispers, "get mad, Roselle. Let the rage and injustice of what they've made you sink in. Together, we'll destroy them all."
"Oh, it's sinking in, just like my claws in your face if you don't leave me alone."
I'm too exhausted to be tactful.
What's this about claws? Grisham asks behind us. The firstborn golden boy is swathed in light from the window. Raken turns to greet him.
Roselle is angry at me, Raken says, because I won't let her out of being my slave for a day. I might have to postpone it, though, otherwise I'll feel cheated. She's restricted to the palace for the briefing, and she has to see a physician.
Grisham grunts. I'm not allowed out right now, either. I don't understand why we can't just go to the trial grounds and watch the secondborn training camps. Roselle already decimated the attackers.
He looks at me with surprising admiration.
Raken snorts in agreement, playing along.
Is it true they didn't have monikers? He asks.
I didn't see any monikers, I reply. Some of it is a blur.
Glisten returns with an armload of items.
I have a few choices for sweaters, she says, holding them up.
Raken reaches out and takes a long, cream-colored one. Shaking it out, he holds it for me. It's more like a coat that clasps in the front, sensor-controlled with a small apparatus on the sleeve to regulate the temperature. Surprised by Raken's gesture, I pause for a moment. Slowly, I turn and thread my arms through the sleeves. Raken's nearness floods my senses. His scent surrounds me. I turn back, and he's already reaching for the clasps, securing the ones to cover my abdomen and leaving the ones below my waist undone. I touch my hair, smoothing it, self-conscious about what I must look like. Glisten hands me matching slippers. I drop them and shove my feet into them without bending down. The fit is perfect, and that annoys me too. These people know entirely too much about me. That's part of their strength. Information is the key to their power. Their data scientists are as lethal with information as I am with a sword.
Water, the assistant says, passing me the glass with ice. And Chets.
She holds up a packet with maybe 20 inside. The value of this in my air barracks back on the base would be stunning.
Thank you.
I accept the Chets, resisting the urge to take a whole one now, and drop them in the pocket of my sweater for later, when I can better afford to be dull. Right now, I need my wits.
Clifton's deep voice greets the liaison at the entrance to the reception area. He looks immediately to me, cuts off the man in front of him with his hand, and walks in my direction.
Roselle.
He says my name with such relief that I feel as if he cares. Large hands reach out for me and hug me.
It's shocking that he's embracing me in a setting like this. He's firstborn, I'm secondborn. The intimacy is taboo. It's also causing excruciating pain in my ribs.
Clifton, I whimper and exhale.
Raken puts his hand on Clifton's shoulder and shoves him away from me.
Don't touch her.
Clifton looks at the hand on his shoulder, then their eyes lock. The arms dealer isn't used to anyone coming between us, and he doesn't like it. Not one bit.
She's injured, Raken adds.
Clifton throws Raken a murderous glare. It was a trying night for him. Many of his friends and associates were murdered. He's probably still adjusting to the shock.
I'll be better in a day, I explain gently.
Clifton's expression softens.
I'm sorry. I've been worried about you. I thought you died last night.
Real sorrow shines in his eyes. I want to fall back into his arms. He's not emotionally bereft like all the other people here. It makes me almost forget he's dangerous.
Almost.
Clifton still has an agenda, and I'm a huge part of it.
Excuse me, sir, a star assistant interrupts Clifton. I was told that you have the surveillance footage.
Clifton nods. He lifts his hand and unlocks his sword-shaped moniker. His eyes open menus made of holographic energy.
Where do I send it?
The man indicates his moniker. Clifton nods and initiates the transfer. Dropping his arm, he says to me,
You haven't introduced me to your friend.
Firstborn Clifton Salloway, I begin, may I introduce firstborn Raken Winterstrom.
Winterstrom, Clifton says,
I don't believe we've met.
We haven't, Raken says.
Clifton gazes at his left hand.
You're a star.
How do you know my Roselle?
Your Roselle?
I'm her commanding officer.
She's an advisor to the Halo Council, of which I'm a member.